Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I am Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in downtown Ames. KHOI Community Radio, a real local treasure. We are glad to be here, and we are glad that you have decided to join us at our kitchen table. Well, fall things today. And we're going to look at the wonderful world of squash.
Yes, pumpkins and squashes. It's the pumpkin and squash time.
It's time.
The frost is almost on the pumpkin.
Almost, not quite.
This is another long fall.
Fall is nipping at my garden, but it looks like there's still something. I had a dahlia actually bloom first year I've grown dahlias. What do I know for dahlias? What a nice thing.
Oh, so gorgeous.
Aren't they wonderful? So, fall things. The last Saturday at the local farmer's market, they had quite a to-do. It was kind of cold and windy, but everyone was in good spirits. They had a Halloween dog costume contest.
Yes, the farmer's market is the parade of dogs.
And it was well done, and there were some dogs are the most long-suffering animals in the world. I mean, there they were. Anyway, lots of fun was had by all. And also, here is a little bit of pumpkin news. I think I try to announce this every year. The world record for the biggest pumpkin. Now, some people obsess about this, growing the largest pumpkin. It seems a big fuss to me, but they get bigger every year, and they have a contest in Half Moon Bay, California. And once again, this guy must have, I don't know what he does to his pumpkins, but Travis...
Probably gives them drugs.
Oh, he must. Travis Geiner, believe it, Anoka, Minnesota. This was the 50th World Championship pumpkin way off, and he won. He won with an enormous lumpy orange pumpkin, and it's, weighed, get this, 2,746 pounds.
Well, I can't imagine that there's a lot of flavor in that pumpkin. What do you do with it when the contest is over?
I don't know. Landscaping. I don't know.
Well, compost, or can you feed it to animals? I mean,
I bet you could. Yeah, I bet you could.
Do you think cattle would eat it? I mean, you'd have to have a lot of pigs to eat that much.
I mean, this is a giant gourd, evidently, and it has been bred to just be big, like, you know, big tomato.
So it's a gourd like a dried, no, it has to have flesh on it.
It's a pumpkin. It's an orange pumpkin, large or, it does say that if you wanted to, it could produce at least 687 pies. But I'm not going to tackle that pumpkin.
My pumpkin pies are not made out of pumpkin.
I learned this.
They're made out
too, of
squash, because there's little more flavor in a squash than most of the pumpkin varieties that are grown in this country are actually, at this point, grown for decorative use.
Oh, right.
And I did read one year that... a lot of, I believe it was Libby's brand canned tomatoes, pumpkins, sorry, seem to be grown in Illinois are actually a variety of butternut squash. Which is how they're pulling for more flavor in their canned squash too. I like to use kabocha squash in mine. I go for the richest, darkest, thickest kind of squash that I can find.
Plying the can opener to open a can actually is nice sometimes too, because I do cook down squash sometimes for this sort of thing. But when I come to making a pie, I kind of grab a can of Libby's or whatever. Or there's an organic varieties too. Anyway, pumpkins. Oh, this guy from Anoka, Minnesota grows his pumpkins in his backyard.
Whoa.
And babies.
That would be some kind of intrusive landscaping, right?
Yeah. And he decided to give his plants extra care, and he watered them 12 times a day, feeding and fertilizing them more than usual.
Mm-hmm.
This can be kind of scary, folks. So the pumpkins just keep getting bigger. But, Donna, I think we should just talk about the kind that we like to do. Pumpkins and
well, you
squash.
Grew some pumpkins this year.
I did,
you?
And actually, I didn't grow big ones. I grew little ones. They are and they are still called a pie pumpkin.
Mm-hmm.
And the variety is called New England Pie Pumpkin. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they're cute, and you know, tabletop size. And I like to always grow. I usually get a package that says mixed ornamental gourds, because I like to see what happens. You know, little things come out and little lumpy things. And I brought some to the radio station.
That's yours out on the front porch?
On the front porch.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't go for size. I just go for colorful, small, and lumpy. So there. We're heading toward the Halloween season, the Thanksgiving season. And there's a lot of good things you can do with squash.
Well, now, is it my imagination, or are we getting more varieties of squash available than we used to have? I mean, when I first moved here, okay, 17 or 18 years ago, I had to really go on a big hunt to find the kabocha squash, which is a lumpy, dark green, I don't know, what do you think, 8 to 10 inches mm-hmm. across, and one of them is plenty for a pie. But this year, I mean, now there's, of course, the butternut, buttercup, which is, the buttercup is fairly close to the kabocha squash. Then there are all these kinds of delicata ones, the long ones, the round ones that have mottled green and white. There's the brown, lumpy ones. I mean, there were so many. I have a lot of different squashes at home, and some of them are, you know, small, and you can just roast them up for a cut them and seed them and roast them for like a single serve portion. We used to do like a stuffed squashes and stuff like that, and there's lots of big ones and small ones and so many different varieties. Did you grow, other than your pumpkins, did you grow squash this year?
Yes, I did. I grow a white acorn squash that I really like, because acorn squash is kind of, I didn't be careful, but I found this version called Thelma Sanders acorn squash.
That's from a sweet one?
Yeah, from Seed Savers. I like that one.
Oh, and it's white. That's pretty.
It's white on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And a bunch of smaller butternuts. They can get really kind of out of control.
Yeah, they can.
But there are, like you said, there's different breeds, different. I referred to a book called Seed to Seed by Susan Ashworth, and the book is all about saving seeds and about the genetics of different vegetables. And her section on squash is like pretty vast, pretty vast. Squash are from the family Cucurbitaceae. And
cucurbits, yeah.
Cucurbits. And she's
which
got,
is cucumber, too,
yeah,
right?
Yep, yeah. Yep. Yeah. And she's got, actually, there's like 5 pages of all the different kinds of squash there.
Well, there's a lot of native squash. You know, the three sisters, mm-hmm. corns and beans and squash are mm-hmm. the things they grow together. Mm-hmm.
There's pumpkins, all kinds. There's Native American pumpkins. There's banana squash. There's buttercup squash, Hubbards and Marrows. And I've heard of this, but I've never had any. The Cushaws, I think, are Cushaws.
Spell it.
Squash. Cushaws.
Huh.
I think that's more of a southwestern thing. And then there's
that might have been some of the Native American original varieties, right.
And then there's the butternuts. And there's something that's related to butternuts. They're called cheese, like Wisconsin cheese, Iowa cheese, flat. They're dandy. And then there's the cocozels and the crooknecks and the summer squashes, scallops, huh? And zucchini, huh? So we can be busy with squash quite all the way through the season. There are three commonly squash Summer squash, winter squash, and pumpkin are three commonly used terms. Mm-hmm. And all squashes can be eaten when young and tender. And all, when mature, turn hard and can be eaten too. But as we know, there's some that are better for early eating and some that are better for this time of year when we're thinking of cooking them. I like squash because they make the house smell good if you're going to be
pumpkin pie is a uniquely American kind of thing. Like in Europe, pumpkins and squash are used. Soup is very common, pumpkin soup, which I like a lot. Mm-hmm. A quick thing I like to do. Now, all of the squashes are basically the same. You cut them in half, take the seeds out, and then you can steam them or roast them. And then some people cut them and then steam them and roast. Some people even peel squash. Okay. I'm sorry. For me, first of all, they're hard peeling. It's hard to work on. It's not like peeling a potato. I like to cook them and then scrape the cooked flesh out with a spoon, a big spoon or something like that. But almost all the squashes are the same now. When I was growing up, the main squash that we ate were acorn squashes, the green, dark green mm-hmm. ones. And the common thing was, of course, to cut them in half and roast them with a little butter, sugar, and salt mm-hmm. or brown sugar. In fact, it was the only vegetable my father would routinely accept. He just did not like, but give him an ache. I guess it was the sugar, right? You know, that worked for him. There are just lots and lots of things you can do for savory squashes. Besides soup, you can make them up kind of like you would a mashed sweet potato as a side dish. You can, I had a wonderful old recipe from a man, what was his name? From Santa Fe area. So it was, you take a large-ish, I mean, we're not talking about really large, you know, 8 to 10 inches, kabocha type of squash or something like that, you know, that's fairly thick on the inside. And you cut the top out like a pumpkin in a round, pull that out, and then you scrape the seeds out and you've got a bowl. And then for the Southwestern version, he just took, you know, New Mexico chilies and made a kind of sauce. You could put meat in it if you wanted to, but anyway, you come with this some, or you could put chili in it, for goodness sake. And then you roast it, you fill the pumpkin up with the chili, put the lid back on it, set it on a baking sheet, and cook it in the oven.
To be clear, the chili should be cooked before you put it
yeah.
in. Yeah. Because what you're doing in the oven is cooking the squash.
Yes. Yeah, you're cooking the squash, and you know, then the chili or the sauce in the middle becomes like a, you know, a heating medium, is it? And then when you take it all out, it's a lovely thing to serve. I used to do it like on a platter, especially if I had like multiple guests or a buffet. I would just put it on a platter of a grain. Like you could put it on polenta or quinoa or even rice, and then you kind of fill the plate with that. Then you set the squash in the middle and just lift the lid off and give it a whack. And so it just kind of splits open and spills all of the sauce out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Really, really yummy, savory dish like that. What else do I, I'm going to make some, pumpkin custards, which is really like taking the pumpkin pie filling and just baking them in a custard dish in the oven. So it's, you know, you don't have the crust and you don't have the extra calories, and it's a, you know, it's loaded with beta carotene and vitamin A. So it's actually fairly healthy to cook that way. So that makes a nice little, you know, simple weeknight dessert. What else? Soups, of course. Yeah. Now the one I'm going to make this week is a brown butter sage soup. So you just cook the pumpkin, you can steam it, you can bake it, you know, then you scrape it out, then you puree it. I've usually put a little stock in it. You could put milk, and then you take a quite generous amount of sage leaves, and you, in a separate pan, you fry them with butter till they're almost black. So you get your brown butter and your sage, and the sage is really crumbly. And then you put it in with the soup mixture and puree the whole thing with an immersion blender. And it's delightful. In fact, that's the best way. I like to, now is the time to pick all the sage that's left in the garden and cook it in butter. It will sit in the refrigerator in a jar, preserved, for several months.
Ah.
And then that way you've got the sage to use. It's wonderful for Thanksgiving and even into Christmas kinds of
I never thought of putting it in the butter and saving it that way. I break up my sage in bunches, and they're hanging up all over the house, turning. They start out pretty green, and then they, of course, dry down to gray.
Yeah.
But the sage is there. It is ready. And that's something.
Well, it preserves those volatile oils
in
the fat of the butter.
The
and that makes it really, really nice.
Ah, very good. I want to go back to cutting open a squash. Because
whack,
it can be kind
whack.
Of... Donna often mentions that being a cook is a very dangerous sort of thing, but this is where you need a big knife and a sharp knife. And we're talking about... I ran across something, some advice that if you have a squash, find the biggest knife you have and put it...
You want a big, thick blade or even a cleaver.
Even a cleaver?
Well, we're talking on the larger squashes.
Yeah,
We're not talking about the little guys.
And you don't always just have to whack it like with the cleaver. You can put the knife across the narrow edge of a long squash, if you have it, or wherever you feel is appropriate, and whack it with the top of, with the heel of your hand. That might get you at least halfway through.
Well, I also find it's easy. First, I stick the point into it and kind of like break the skin so I get a little point where I have leverage. And if it's really hard, I have been known to take one of my thick-bladed knives and actually take a little hammer and tap, 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 tap on it till it starts to move into it, like pounding a nail. They can be daunting.
Daunting. But it's win some, lose some, because it's that kind of biomass.
Yeah, and be careful. Don't break your knife doing
this.
Oh, right.
Yes. That means these things can store for a while. But once you cut it open, okay, so let's say you've got a long...
Butternut.
The long one that looks kind of like a peanut. You cut that open. You can slice it long ways, maybe. Do you cook it open side up or open side down?
Oh, I always cook open side up. I don't know why. And like on a butternut or something, I'll rub the top with a little olive oil or something to, you know, keep it from drying out and
that
making
does help.
It soft.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Oh, or you can steam. Actually, with butternuts, sometimes, especially if they're large, I will cut them not in half the long way. I'll cut them in half the short way first. And then doing that long slicing is a little bit easier.
Ah, very good.
Because butternut can be actually quite dense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. But that's good. And then there's some people really like the delicata, the little striped ones.
Oh, those are beautiful.
Yes, a delicata, yes, they are.
I had dinner at my friend Lou and Ann's the other night, and Lou took the delicata and made, visually it looked like she cut it in half first, and then she made really thin slices, like quarter-inch slices, and kind of fanned them out on a roasting sheet and roasted them. And the skin was tender enough to eat the skin.
Oh, I love to eat the skin.
Yeah.
Most of them, if you really cook the squash, the skin, I like to eat potato skins too, so I don't.
Some of them not, I think kabocha is too thick-skinned, and pumpkins are generally not, the skin is not attractive.
But it's crunchy, it's good.
But butternut skin is kind of thin and good. There are plenty that you can eat the skin on.
I have a delicata sitting on the counter at home. I should try that, the cutting it up into small bits. I kind of like that idea.
Well, it was small, thin slices,
so it was
like half-moon slices, quite as thin as you can manage. Mm-hmm. And I think she put some kind of sauce on, or would be good with some brown butter sage, roasted like that. Yeah.
There you go.
Well, I was going to go on a rant today about the ubiquitous pumpkin pie spice, right? pumpkin pie latte, pumpkin pie popcorn, pumpkin pie
air freshener.
Yeah. Oh, yes, for goodness sake.
If when it starts to be produced on a huge scale, it kind of ends up smelling kind of funny.
I never buy pumpkin pie spice. You can, it's what people, you know, it's ubiquitous in the grocery store all year long. But I make my own mixture. You like, for example, the pumpkin cobbler recipe that we have on the Donalon Kitchen website. It's cinnamon, ginger, clove, and nutmeg, and then I also add coriander seed ground into those are kind of the go to. And I would encourage you to make your own spice mix.
Yeah, why should spices all be sitting together? Although it's like mixing colors. The idea of mixing things together. And there's so many possibilities.
Well, I was seeing, so Evan Clayman, who does the Good Food Radio show on KCRW in LA, had an article that I read it just this morning. I thought, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. She was complaining about where did this pumpkin pie spice everything come from? And it was a marketing campaign, mm-hmm. a very successful one. You know, that was kind of invented to sell more pumpkin pie spices. And, you know, then she did an interview with this chef who runs a company in New York called La Boite, L-A, capital B-O-I-T-E, which sells really high-quality seasoning spice mixes, sort of like another, like Burlap and Barrel, where we also buy spice mixes. So this chef had an article where he talks about, he's an Israeli chef, but he lives in New York, the top 10 blends for fall baking. Because you do want warm, the marketing sell for pumpkin pie spice is built on the idea of warming spices. You know, you're ready for a little, at those deeper flavorings when the fall comes along. So he says he's picked out, And a lot of these are Middle Eastern in origin because that's where a lot of those spices come from. So he's listed, I'm going to read some of these combinations, not that I'm going to purchase them, but these are, if you have the single spices, you can make your own blends. And this is to encourage you to experiment. So he says one from Yemen, which is cinnamon, ginger, and allspice. Says in Yemen, the blend is traditionally stirred into hot coffee. There's your pumpkin pie spice blend that's not pumpkin pie spice. And he also suggests Yemen oatmeal raisin cookies. Then he's got one from, this is Arabic. Baharat means spices. It's the Middle Eastern version of garam masala, ubiquitous in both sweet and savory dishes. And it is allspice, clove, and cinnamon. It's definitely a great go-to warm, cozy blend, which seems to work in everything, especially, says, pumpkin pecan pie. So that's a really nice mix. Allspice, clove, and cinnamon. You've probably all got all of those in your kitchen cupboard. And, of course, I would recommend fresh grinding any of those things, either with a mortar and pestle or use your spice grinder. Another, he's got a Sri Lankan blend, which is cinnamon, star anise, and nutmeg. Sri Lankans, we should talk about the cinnamons, okay? There are three kinds of cinnamon. It's not just cinnamon, right? There's the kind that everybody thinks of as cinnamon, which is cassia, which is a fairly hard stick, and, you know, it's what you buy when you buy ground cinnamon. There's also Vietnamese cinnamon, which has more heat. It's like, did you have those red hot candies, these tiny little things you were a kid, with that heat? That is the Vietnamese cinnamon flavor. It's got more kick. And then there's Ceylon cinnamon, which is also called, and this one is called, here he calls it the Sri Lankan soft stick cinnamon, is mild and floral. It's also used in a lot of Mexican foods and Central America. It has a softer, more tender bark and is ideal for baking in many of the world's most popular savory dishes like mole, South Asian curries. He uses it in a sweet dish, Turkey's coffee tiramisu. and red wine poached pears. That's a classic. I use it a lot. And it is, since it is a soft stick cinnamon, it's really easy to grind your own in the coffee mill. You just kind of break it in pieces with your fingers and grind it up. Or you can buy it ground. Around here, any good Mexican, you know, grocery store will have packages. That's the kind of cinnamon that you'll see when they say, it's called canela. There's another name for it. So those are all the same. So he's got it with cinnamon, star anise, and nutmeg. Really easy to make that one. Then he's got something. I might order this one. Okay, it's smoked cinnamon, smoked cassia cinnamon. Smoking the sticks of fragrant cassia cinnamon, which is the basic cinnamon that everybody calls cinnamon, adds addictive depth and dimension to our smoked cinnamon. Try swapping it in your favorite chocolate chip cookies, French toast, or spiced raisin marmalade, all kinds of things. I'm kind of curious about. Here he's got another mixture with honey, star anise, ginger, and cinnamon. So it's called Reims, R-E-I-M-S, which is a city in Paris. It is the home of a French very common thing called pain de pice, which is bread of spices. It's a French version of a quick bread that is a cross between a gingerbread and a fruitcake kind of thing. Really common. And it's made with honey, usually, star anise again, ginger and cinnamon. He talks about using it in chocolate truffles, which I think is a great idea. Oh, he's got another one here. This is an interesting blend. Sweet baking, cardamom, coffee, and honey. We make these blend for a certain French chef, a friend. It's perfectly suited to seasoning, baked goods, desserts, and beverages. So it's got coffee in it. So when I'm baking anything chocolate, I always put a little bit of, I usually use like King Arthur's has a coffee flavoring, or you can use instant coffee, or if it's a wet thing, you can, you know, make a fresh little bit of espresso, because you don't taste it and you don't want enough to say it's mocha, but that coffee, the bitterness of the coffee really kind of doubles the chocolate whammy of what you're getting. But this one is a blend of cardamom coffee and honey. Says sprinkle it into your morning coffee. There you go, Mike. It's cardamom coffee and honey. Mike was saying, our engineer was saying, he'd heard about putting cardamom in his coffee. I'm a big fan of cardamom in my coffee. Here's another one. Oh, he uses rose in this one. He calls it chai. Star anise, cardamom, and rose. Great for spiced tea, hot chocolate, and oatmeal. This one caught Lana's eye. Apollonia. It's cocoa powder, orange blossom, which must be a dehydrated, you know, usually you can buy orange flower water or orange blossom in a liquid form, and black pepper, which is another thing I always put into my sweets. Not enough that you taste it, but just to give everything a little bite. And here's another one with rose, which is, so rose petals. Which you can buy those separate and make your own. And Bombay, turmeric, fenugreek, and clove. Bombay pairs so well with sweet root vegetables like carrot, kabocha squash, and sweet potatoes. And he uses it in his carrot cake even. Ooh. So that does sound like a nice combination to sprinkle on. Now, he's got clove in it. When you're using clove, you only need a little bit, right? Sprinkling it on your roasted root vegetables in the oven and things like that.
Well, my brain is thinking
fall. So yes, get really creative. This is from, if you want to look this article up, it's on, the recipe is called La Boite, LABOITE. I think it's a company in New York. But it will give you a lot of ideas for seasoning.
Ooh,
besides the pumpkin pie spice, ooh, which I think everybody could easily make their own and kind of vary it to suit themselves.
Give your taste buds a new treat here. This is KHOI, and this is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lena Kitchen. Pumpkin spice pie spice, Donna. We're doing everything but because life is too short. Yes, it is.
Mix up your spice blends here.
Thinking about fall and things that have kind of a fall touch to them, I ran across a really interesting poem about wieners, Donna. We don't think about wieners.
What are you doing? Having a wiener roast or something?
Well, doesn't that make you think about fall? On a past Donna Lena show, we reviewed the book The Food of a Younger Land by Mark Kurlansky, and this is a collection of all sorts of things all over the country about regional food.
That's the food writing that was done during the Depression it's not the WPA. But
no, there was a whole different thing.
For writers.
That the writers group there, and they gathered things, and there was this whole pile of information, and they were going to publish it, and then World War II happened, so it kind of put a kibosh on this project, and then Mark Kurlansky, who is a contemporary writer, got all this stuff together and pulled out some really interesting things that were written about local. Talk about local foods. This is food before we had things like supermarkets and Uber. And this is like
internet, right?
Yeah. So things were a bit more regional. And I ran across this poem in here. There's not many poems, but there it is. This one is called Nebraskans Eat the Wieners. Okay? It's by a
Nebraskans Eat the Wieners.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's by a poet named Hans Christensen. And I first read this, and I thought, Hans Christian Andersen wrote a poem about Nebraska wieners? And then I looked again, because I figured, how in the world would he... Okay, never mind. It's not Hans Christian Andersen.
No, no.
It's Hans Christensen. And I like a good hot dog. I like a good wiener. Here's what this poem says. Nebraskans eat their wieners. Nebraskans eat their wieners, and they are considered swell. They are eaten by the millions. That is one way you can tell. Some fry them in a skillet. Others boil them deep in kraut. But the man who knows his wieners and what it's all about is the one who builds a fire in a forest or a park, then watch them sizzle to a brown as the dusk turns to dark. And as a center of attraction, here are the solid facts we own for a tasty outdoor morsel. The wiener is a class alone. This is true in town or city. That's when folks go out to play. Old Mr. Wiener goes along, and it's the hero of the day. Then, while he's turning juicy, folks sing songs of long ago, like Auld Lang Syne and Annie Laurie, Moonlight Bay and Old Black Joe. We believe that if Napoleon, in retreating from the cold, could have had Nebraska hot dogs, he would made it to the fold. There. Little thought on wieners. And I, you know, cooking stuff over an outdoor fire along with a couple marshmallows, I think that'd be a pretty good thing. There we go. That was from the book Food of a Younger Land by Mark Kurlansky, a poem about wieners. Let's get back to some more local food, Donna. What's up?
Well, actually, while we were talking about historical things.
Oh, good, yes.
I ran across this. It's like a 5-minute video, but it is beautiful. It's called Pomological. So, and it's on, I would encourage anybody who wants a 5 minutes of inspiration of culinary history, it's on a website called Aeon, AEON.com. And it's, so basically what it's about, in 1886, a U.S. agency set out to record new fruit varieties. Now, this is because this was before photography was developed that much, so it had to all be, hand-drawn. So this was the Department of the USDA embarked on an ambitious project to help fruit cultivars protect and profit from their innovations. The agency hired illustrators to recreate images of newly developed varieties of fruits and nuts, capturing the colors, textures, and shapes in intricate detail. By the program's end in 1942, more than 7,500 unique and often beautiful images had been produced. So there's a Toronto filmmaker who's made a short film of it, Pomological Watercolor Collection, to explore the history and the legacy. It's a, just a charming, charming look at, you know, how the U.S. Department of Agriculture was helping the American fruit growers develop new varieties and things like that. And it's just beautiful and kind of restorative to look at.
Yeah, I looked at that. It's just all of these old, the watercolors and the variety of fruits, the colors, the imperfections, they're all absolutely... Thinking about photography, this was 1886. Well, they had photography then, but unfortunately not color photography.
No, not at all.
So these paintings, these watercolors are absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, and it's... So I'll say it again. How would you pronounce? A-E-O-N. I'm never good at that. Aeon... Aeon.com, A-E-O-N.com, and then under there it's called the Pomological, and it's just a 5-minute little film that's, you know, share it with your friends when you want to give them a little breath of fresh air.
It's so pretty. There you go. There you go. Oh, I have another pumpkin squash related thing to mention. On the Donalana Kitchen website that you can find at www.khoyfm.org, go to the Donalana section there, we have a recipe page. And on that recipe page, there is a pumpkin pie that doesn't taste anything like pumpkin pie spice. It's called Provençal pumpkin pie. It's a French pumpkin pie. And that is, as I recall, is flavored with orange zest, and Madeira.
Right. There
so
you
can
go.
So you do lots of different things. Right. There you go. So that's worth a look.
You know what I forgot in the pumpkin spice mix to talk about ginger.
Ginger.
There's, of course, powdered ginger, which is fairly ubiquitous. But using fresh ginger is really nice and gives your... any of your pumpkin pie things a good kick. Now, the you know, you buy this sort of knobby-looking wooden thing that's full of fibers, and, you know, you can kind of lightly peel the outside nut, you know, depends on how... When you're buying it, try to buy the least dried-out-looking one, okay?
This is the Midwest.
The biggest,
fleshy one that you can
find, right?
Yeah.
And keep store them in the refrigerator. I have a Japanese, it's more like a rasp than a grater. It doesn't have holes in it. I mean, you can lightly peel the skin off and use a microplane zester, and that will give you a good ginger thing. Or this rasp thing, which is, it's a Japanese tool where you can grate on it, and then it kind of purees the juice out of it. You can also buy ginger juice. I think that, you know, the company that makes those ginger candies called the Ginger People, they have a juice which is, I think, a little better than the dry ginger. Also, sometimes I double the ginger by putting some dried and some fresh, because it kind of gives you two slightly different flavors. So go for that fresh ginger. It's really, I mean, even if you're making gingerbread, for example. I'm getting the urge to make gingerbread soon.
I was thinking of
chunking in some apples into that gingerbread and then topping it with a mixture of, say, whipped cream, which I have incorporated, you know, with sugar, of course, incorporated a little sour cream to make it taste more like the French creme fraiche. It makes it heavier. And, you know, I don't know. That's what I was thinking of baking this week. Gingerbread.
Ooh, see? We're into fall here. We're into fall. This is KHOI and this is Donalana Kitchen. We'll just move right along here because we've got lots of other stuff to get to. I want to mention, speaking of spices, I've been trying to recreate a jam.
Oh, yeah.
I... I made it a couple years ago because I ran across this recipe sitting in a doctor's office, and you pick up the magazines there, and that looked good, and I went home and did it, and of course I didn't write it. I didn't keep the recipe, but it's spicy tomato paprika jam, and I looked around, and good old Martha Stewart had something similar, mm-hmm. so I made it. I made it, and it's not quite there yet, but here is basically what we did here. 12 pounds of tomatoes in a big pot, because this is a big recipe, 2 cups of sugar, a juice of 1 lime, and 2.5 teaspoons of cumin, but then 5...
Ground cumin. Yeah.
Believe it or not, 5 tablespoons of smoked paprika. You'd think that'd be a lot, but you're fighting with the tomatoes here.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
then a little shy tablespoon of cayenne, because that helps.
Tablespoon.
That's what it said. And it.
Oh, it, I would put teaspoon.
It's probably a tea. Anyway.
Yeah.
I have a tea here. Maybe it's a teaspoon. Then a little salt, and I said the 2 cups of sugar. Anyway, that ends up. Jams don't always have to be sweet. This is a spicy.
But it sounds like an
thing.
Adult ketchup sort
it
of.
It is. And I've yeah. been. So that was a fine thing to do. And another thing for a spice. There you go.
Right. And something even. You could make that as a, like a. Some, you know, a condiment that you set on, even using tinned tomatoes, just make your own with mm-hmm. the cumin, the paprika. A little bit of cayenne and some sugar.
That's right.
And actually, well, ketchup has sugar in it.
Yeah.
It is.
It
always does.
Yeah, it is
that. So this is just, there's no vinegar in it. Oh, no. Lime. Lime makes it acidulated.
It's a full lime.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I did not peel my tomatoes. I took the cores out. You don't need to because it kind of cooks down to this glop. My original recipe, the one that I found in the doctor's office, called for... The recipe made with small yellow cherry tomatoes, sun golds that everybody likes.
Yeah.
And that was absolutely gorgeous.
Oh, I
didn't have enough little ones. So
not
I put
this
it
time of year, things. Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, Lana, I'm surprised. You usually tell me you don't like smoked paprika.
I have to confess, I kind of did half and half. I did have smoked paprika.
Half smoked and half sweet.
Regular.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of working my way into a smoky taste because this this is supposed to be kind of a spicy thing.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm making big strides.
Well,
in
I guess I'm going to have to order that smoked cinnamon and see if Lana will eat it.
I'm kind of a, don't give me smoky stuff. It tastes burnt. No, it doesn't. No, okay, I'll work my way up. Well, actually, I've got a crock pot going today, and I put a little smoked paprika in it just to see what it would be like. So we'll see. It is a fine fall taste. And this spicy tomato paprika jam was a nice thing to do with leftover tomatoes, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, very good.
Well, now, the one thing we haven't talked about, because it is root vegetable season,
mm-hmm.
And it's time to store the vegetables that we're collecting. Some of them have to go in the refrigerator,
mm-hmm.
Like carrots, beets, parsnips, rutabagas, turnips, these things, celeriac, which is celery root, I love. This is all looking really good right now. So these have to be in the refrigerator. Cold and very moist. So you want a high humidity in your fridge. This is how you can store them. And most of these will hold till Christmas. I mean, if you're really lucky and you have a spare refrigerator for like you want to buy 20 pounds of carrots and store them, that is a good way to do the other things that, now, how do you store your potatoes, Lana? Dark, for one thing.
Dark, in the basement, and make sure it's in the dry part of the basement. Dark and dry.
Oh, well, in here they say cold and moist.
Oh, well, they would.
Potatoes, cabbage, cauliflower, apples, pears, quince, cold and moist.
Well, I always think my basement is dry, but maybe it's not because...
Well, this is the Midwest. Your basement is probably damp.
Oh, okay. Anyway, potatoes, basement,
yeah,
dark.
Dark, for sure. The light makes them get all green and actually, if they get too green, you can't eat them. It's slightly toxic.
Yeah, I think you can kind of make yourself sick. Okay.
Yeah, you got to peel all that off. Now, cool and dry.
Yes.
So, like, I keep mine in my pantry, which is fairly dark. Garlic, onions. You have lots of onions. How do you store your onions?
See, I look for microclimates in my house. You got the cool part and dark place in the basement, but then I have another place that's closer to the stairs that is dry. So onions go in, well, right now they are hanging in my shed. I bunch them up and hang them to dry.
So before the frost.
Before the frost. So I will take them down and put them in big boxes, well, you know, like grape boxes or peach boxes, and they will be stacked in my basement by the stairs where it is a little warmer. And actually, that's a good thing to kind of check on them every now and then.
Oh, yeah, they can rot and sprout really quickly. It's like I keep a kind of a large bowl of them, and I always have to rummage through to look for the green spouts and use those up first. And garlic
too.
Oh, we have a whole, because Lana grows so much garlic, we have a whole thing going with garlic. First they, you know, pick it and dry it and hang it, and right now it's just perfect. But there's so much of it, there comes a point where you want to catch it before it starts to sprout. And at that point, actually, Lana's husband and I often do this. He brings me large bunches of them, and I break them into individual cloves, leaving the skin on. And then I freeze them in you know, sort of more sandwich-sized freezer bags and take them out, you know, and use them all year long. So freezing garlic is a really good way to preserve it. When does it usually sprout?
Well,
Christmas or slightly after
Christmas, but long about February, it's thinking of growing. And if you come across garlic in your storage that has a little bit of green, as opposed to green on potatoes, which is not good, it's okay to eat that. Think of like when spring onions go up. The garlic is trying to be,
you know, a lot of recipes will tell you if it's green, you have to take the green spike out because it's bitter. Well, I don't know what kind of garlic they're eating, but the garlic that we grow here, you don't want to let it go too long because that's what you're trying to avoid. But if it's got the green spike in it, I just chop it in with the rest of it.
It's pretty tiny usually anyway. Yeah. A larger green spike, the bulb itself will start to give up and put all its energy into the
green.
Then you know well enough to throw it away.
Yeah. Now, the other thing for storing is pumpkins and winter squash and sweet potatoes. And this is a book called Root Cellaring, Natural Cold Storage of Fruits and Vegetables. Mike and Nancy Boobel? B-U-B-E-L? Boobel? Whatever. This is an old book. Lana and I each have a copy. For moderately warm and dry. So I just kind of stack all my squash in a big shelf in my pantry. And usually it'll hold through. You gotta watch for if it gets too dry. And sweet potatoes too. Just keep kind of digging through to make sure nothing's going off. But they will usually hold through Christmas.
Yeah, they will. I was surprised. I thought I made the mistake once of trying to keep sweet potatoes in the refrigerator.
They're not happy there.
They like to be kind of warm and dry. Not warm.
Well, and the other thing is somebody gave me a bunch of squash that they had been, they got it through their CSA and they'd been saving it in a plastic bag. And when I got it home, it was like, oh, I had to rinse them off because the plastic was holding too much moisture and they were starting to get mold on them, which is no. So be sure to not store them in plastic bags. They need a lot of air and circulation around.
Remember, we were talking about those hard skins? They're kind of, They keep pretty well because of that. Also, kind of keep in mind you've got different microclimates in your house. In the past, and I don't know, I don't have that many this year, but one year I grew a whole lot of squash, and a good place was underneath my bed.
Oh.
I mean, it's kind of cooler and it is dry, and I put it on some cardboard so you could pull it out every now and then, and you know, gives you a reason to dust under the bed once, you know. Anyway, that seemed to be a good plan. That seemed, anyway.
Yeah, so get your squash and sweet potatoes. The local ones are freshly dug right now. Good time. And you can just store them at room temperature.
Mm-hmm. And if they're freshly dug by farmers that know what they're doing, they probably were cured a little bit, left out in the sun for a day or two. They should be cured a little bit because it'll help the skin.
Well, and squash needs to be cured a little bit too. It's like once you pick it, it needs to sit for a week or two, and it kind of, as I would say, it sugars up.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I had ordered some chestnuts, and the same thing. I ordered them from Valley Chestnut, that mm-hmm. Iowa grower, and they send them in the mail. And I was so excited, and I roasted up a few, and I thought, these are not sweet yet. And I realized they need to sit in the refrigerator and cure for a little bit, too.
Ah, there you go. Well,
And you have to store the chestnuts in the refrigerator.
Yeah. They are not like a hard nut.
No.
I want to mention, we've got, we've talked about all kinds of things today. I got another book that we're going to dive into later, but coming up is our exploration of a brand new book called Company, one of these big, heavy recipe books. Company, Recipes, Menus, Advice by the author Amy Thielen. Thielen.
She's a Northern Minnesota chef. We've reviewed some of her other books where she really covers Midwestern cuisine in a very fundamentally delicious way.
And she writes about, well, of course, lovely pictures. But and this book is called Company because she talks about cooking for a crowd. And so, what's nice about it, it's not fussy. It's not your lace tablecloth. She talks about quantity and cleaning up and planning and planning for a nice, good evening. She has some nice holiday recipes in here, too, which will get us into more of the winter here. And there's a recipe for sopped greens with butter roasted walnuts. So roast your walnuts in butter or olive oil and with a garlic clove and rosemary and put it over cooked greens. You probably this time of year have some greens sticking up in what's left of your garden.
Collards, kale.
Yeah, I've got
great
some odds
kale
and ends.
Right now, yeah.
And to roast or butter roasted walnuts with a little garlic and butter and olive oil and ground black pepper.
You probably can push that till it's brown buttered.
Ooh. That sounds like a good thing to put over your...
Well, her recipe is you steam the greens first, and then you use the brown butter, walnuts, garlic as a topping.
Ha. Sounds like fall to me. Boy, we have been talking about fall. We talked about the book Glute Cellaring by Mike and Nancy Bluebell. We talked about the book Company by Amy Thielen, more to come. And Food of a Younger Land by Mark Kurlansky. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen on this fine radio station. You can find us every Tuesday at noon or 7 p.m. or anytime, or we have a podcast.
Right. Wherever you listen to podcasts, you just type in Donalana, that's one word, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, second word, kitchen, and there we will be.
We've had music by the Barn Owl Band. Earlier you heard Cold Frosty Morning, and we'll go out with Waltz of the Young Girls. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Fine engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.